The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning on this Wisconsin snowy morning day. That's part of what we get here in Wisconsin. It's actually quite beautiful. You all stay safe navigating in it. The oral argument we have today is 24 AP 717 SEIU versus work, W-E-R-C. Appearances, please. Not to be rude, but we typically, you know, often the client or the person will come to court, but that isn't what we typically do. So I'm going to just say let's stick with tradition for now. No offense to anybody. Just we recognize you're here. Nice to have you here. Okay. All right. So the lineup that I have is 25 minutes, followed by 5 minutes, Attorney Davis, followed by 25 minutes, followed by 5 minutes. That's everyone's understanding? Perfect. With that, let's proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the Court. This case centers on the question of whether the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics Authority, its employees, and their chosen representatives are subject to the Wisconsin Peace Act, and more specifically, whether the authority is a person under the Peace Act, and therefore an employer under Section 111.02 sub 7 of the Act. Since the Peace Act and Chapter 233, which is the statute that created or the chapter that created the authority back in 1995, since those acts were amended in 11, the Court has very much clarified and developed the law on how courts are to approach statutory interpretation.
I want to talk about that, counsel. You say in your brief, your reply brief sort of doubles down on it, that before we get to statutory history, you need to identify some ambiguity in the text. And that's just contrary to what all of our cases really say in the last at least 20 years, including Bray, which was a unanimous opinion by this Court. That made clear that it is, in fact, part of a plain meaning analysis. In other words, you don't look myopically at the text, but statutory history, as since it is enacted law, is part of the way we make sense of the text. That's the way we read statutes. And case after case after case, we do that very thing. It seems that your argument is entirely premised on sort of a myopic focus on text and ignoring the statutory history context.
I'm sorry, that is not the impression I mean to give, Your Honor. As case after case after case has affirmed, statutory interpretation begins with the current statutory language, including the surrounding provisions. If the meaning is plain, the Court may stop there and then go ahead and enforce the unambiguous terms. But it also does have the option, and I don't mean to disagree with that. It has the option, but it's not required to go on to consider statutory history to confirm the reading.
But you do say in your reply brief that that the authority's analysis ignores that in order to get to the statutory history, you need to identify an ambiguity in the statutory text. And that's just not what our cases say at all.
Well, what the authority did was it started with the history and used that to get to a foregone conclusion.
We have lots of cases where, again, making sense of the text starts with the statutory history. I'm aware of any case at all in the last at least couple of decades at the court that suggests that before you can look at statutory history, you need to start. You need to identify an ambiguity in the text to get there, which is what you say in your reply brief.
You start with the plain text, as always, and I believe the court has said repeatedly, you always start with the plain text. If that's ambiguous, then you can go all kinds of different places. If it's not ambiguous, you reach a conclusion based on the plain text of the current statute, and then you can go on and look at other sources as well.
So you're maintaining your argument that you cannot look at statutory history unless there is an ambiguity in just the words of the statute apart from our statutory history?
No. You can look at the statutory history after reaching a plain meaning analysis, of determination of what the unambiguous current statutory language says, and then you can go on and look at the surrounding language. Actually, you don't even have to wait to look at the surrounding language. You can look at the surrounding current language as well. And in this case, I would suggest the way to do that is to look at the definition of person and look at the definition of corporation. And then you can look at the exceptions to employer.
But Bray and our other cases don't say you read the text, you look only at the text, you isolate the text, you give some interpretation of that, you can't look at these other things. Bray says that and it doesn't do anything groundbreaking, which is why it is unanimous with regard to this point, that the statutory history is a part of a plain meaning analysis. I mean, you look at that as a way to make sense of what the text says. That has been what our cases say. And I think they've been very consistent in that.
I think in Bray, the court found that a literal interpretation of the relevant subsection, the very, very focused, micro-focused language that one of the parties wanted the court to look at, it found that that clashed with the surrounding existing statutory language. We don't have anything similar to that here. No one is saying that any of the current language somehow clashes with the rest of the current language of the statute. And it was the surrounding language of the existing statute that led the court to its conclusion in Bray. And I would refer you to paragraphs 14 through 19. Of the Bray decision.
But counsel, statutory history, which I think Justice Hagedorn is trying to get at, is part of the analysis. It's not a step two. It's not we look at the text and then we ignore statutory history. It's, I believe in Banuelos we said it's part and parcel of the plain meaning analysis. And I think what your argument is asking this court to do is backtrack off of, again, at least two decades of cases that recognized a distinction between statutory history and legislative history, which is extrinsic to the analysis. And we don't go there. I think everybody agrees. But I think what you're advocating for is sort of this strict construction of the statutory text that ignores the context of Act 27 and Act 10. Under Act 27, back in the 90s, the authority was made an employer expressly in the statutory text, and that was repealed in Act 10. And I think you're asking us to ignore that it was repealed in Act 10, and we don't do that as part of our analysis unless we're going to completely undo Kalal and Bray, which, again, was not a groundbreaking case. It just simply reiterated what we've been saying for two decades, which, admittedly, the court kind of melded the two, statutory history and legislative history, and sometimes referred to it incorrectly as one and the same. Of course, it's not. There's a big distinction. So are you asking us to backtrack off of Kalal and Bray and Banuelos, our recent cases?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. All of those cases that you just mentioned all began with a review of the plain text, and then they went on to look at the statutory history. Banuelos, in particular, reached the conclusion of what the statute meant based on a plain text reading, and that was in paragraph 24. And then the conclusion that the court had reached based on that plain text was confirmed with a review of the statutory history.
But it's not a confirmation. Banuelos is probably a really good case for us to look at. And if we apply Banuelos and Bray faithfully, I don't see how you win. On Banuelos, it was the statute used to provide for a fee for electronic records, and then it was repealed. We've got the same situation here. What possible distinction can you draw between the
cases? So in Banuelos, the court said in paragraph 41, we remain wedded to the statutory definition of patient health care records, determining that all does indeed mean all. I would say the same thing about the definition of person. Person means corporations. It doesn't mean only some corporations. Just because they took out the provision that explicitly identified the authority as an employer doesn't remove the fact that the authority still is an employer under the definition that remains. The general terms canon, as discussed in the Benson case, Benson quoted Justice Scalia about the general terms canon, and it held that the word corporation in the definition of person presumptively included more specific types of corporation. The authority is a political corporation. So applied here, the Benson case means that the authority as a political corporation is a person and therefore subject to the Peace Act. The fact that that Act 11 took out a specific reference doesn't remove the fact that it remained part of the definition, and the legislature knows how to write somebody out of a statute. They did that in the Peace Act, where there is a whole section of exceptions from the definition of employer. Those exceptions are the state, political subdivisions, and unions. The legislature could have, if it meant to, could have included the Hospital and Clinics Authority in that list of exceptions, and it did not. It knew how to do it, and it did not do it.
So you're asking us to not take account of the statutory history. You would like us to read the text, stop there, ignore Act 27 and Act 10.
Well, the statutory history confirms the plain language reading that I'm advocating here, Your Honor. The court doesn't have to go to statutory history at all, and case after case after case says that. You can look at the plain language. If it's unambiguous, you apply it, and that can be that. If you want to go on and look at statutory history, you can. And as Chief Justice Ziegler said in 2015, writing for the majority of the court in Anderson versus All, the circumstances under which statutory history may be consulted when we're talking about a plain meaning interpretation, she wrote that a reviewing court may verify a plain meaning interpretation by consulting statutory history. This was consistent with Crown Castle, the 2012 case, where the court considered statutory history only after reaching an interpretation of the current statute's plain meaning, and then went on to context and then statutory history to confirm the reading of the plain text.
I think that's where I'm confused on this one. So are you saying, and I think maybe I share some of the concerns with my colleagues on the other end of the bench, are you saying that statutory history can only be used to confirm the plain meaning, or are you saying that statutory history, like context, like it says in paragraph 46 of, it's K-Law, not K-Law, it's K-Law, guys. Okay. I know. Eventually we'll get there. Ralph would appreciate it. Or is it like it says in paragraph 40 cents of K-Law that that statutory history, like context, is important to meaning. So is the structure of the statute. I'm not sure exactly what your argument is. I can't tell if you are saying it is only to confirm, or can we look at it in addition to. And I'm not even talking about ambiguity. I'm not even going to go there yet.
We have an unambiguous statute. The court has determined the language is unambiguous. Under Fleming, in particular, the 2023 decision, also written by Chief Justice Ziegler, consulting extrinsic sources confirms the plain meaning. And when the statute is unambiguous, the court can nonetheless consult extrinsic sources, such as legislative history, but only to confirm the plain meaning. The court also has said in... Sorry, I've got too many things going
just
on
here. Just to be clear while you're looking for things, legislative history and statutory history have a distinction.
They're two different things.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think I just made know that distinction in my writings, to be clear.
Yeah, I just want to know when, under your argument, comes the point in time when we are trying to figure out what a statute means that we go to statutory history.
You can look at statutory history whenever you want to.
Well, wait a minute, Counsel. I don't mean to interrupt your line, but that's not a principled basis by which to interpret a statute. That suggests outcome-oriented decision-making. I want to reach a certain outcome. Statutory history doesn't work for that outcome, so I'm going to ignore it. We don't do that, Counsel. We either look at statutory history or we don't. And as Justice Hagedorn and I have made the point over and over today, for at least two decades, this court has been explicit and quite clear that statutory history is part of a plain meaning analysis. Sometimes it doesn't come into play because there isn't any relevant statutory history. But here it is relevant, and you're not really asking us to look at it if we want to and ignore it if we feel like it, right? That's not what you're really arguing, are you?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that case after case after case, beginning with Kalal, and probably earlier.
Kalal, hard
Kalal,
A. Kalal. We can do it, people. I know we can.
Kalal, Fleming, multiple cases cited in our briefs say you start with the plain text. You reach a reading if you determine the language is unambiguous. You can stop at that point. You don't have to look at statutory
history. I don't think we
can.
I think we have to look at statutory history whenever it exists, and it may be relevant to the analysis. If we want to, that's not a principled basis.
But
would you agree with that?
I agree that once you've reached a reading of an unambiguous text, the only reason to look at anything else is to verify the reading, and that's what...
That's contrary to what we just said in Bray and in Banuelos.
Is that the same for context?
I'm sorry?
Is your argument the same for context, that if we have an unambiguous statute and the plain meaning is clear, that we only look to context to confirm the meaning?
No, I think you can look at... you look at the plain, the actual language that people are fighting about, and then you also look at the context of that language in the statute.
Does that differ?
That is the first step.
Okay. And my question to you is, does the way we treat statutory history differ than how we treat, say, context?
Yes. You don't have to look at statutory history. You can.
And you have
case after case after case says you don't have to. What I think the cases also say is that you do have to look at both the micro bit that everybody's fighting about as well as how that fits into the bigger picture of the statute at issue. So here we're talking about the definition of person and the meaning of corporation. But you can also look at, and you should also look at, the rest of chapter, or the rest of 111.01, the Peace Act, which includes exceptions to who an employer is, and the legislature could have and did not add the UW Hospital and Clinics Authority to those exceptions.
Counsel, your client went to federal court and argued that you were in fact removed and represented that to a court of law. That the interpretation is entirely contrary to what you're arguing before us today. What do we make of that?
So the Walker administration and many others were saying in 2011 that the Peace Act amendments and the amendments to the state's other labor laws caused SEIU members and other unionized employees to lose their state law collective bargaining rights. The parties in WEAC versus Walker, which is the federal court case that you're talking about, including SEIU, argued in federal court that these changes to the state labor laws violated the U.S. Constitution. That case was ultimately decided for the Walker administration, but here we are 14 years after that lawsuit was started, and in the past 14 years, this court's law on statutory interpretation has developed by leaps and bounds, to be honest. There is nothing in the statute itself, the current statute, that supports the position that the administration took then in light of the developed law.
It was your clients that actually went to court. I mean, your argument was premised on the idea that the collective bargaining rights that were previously put in law were removed, and you argued doing so was unconstitutional. So your argument, I mean, you represented in federal court that the statute had exactly the effect you're saying right now. It does not.
SEIU was faced with an administration that told them that they could no longer have recognized collective bargaining rights.
But you went to court and said you don't anymore, not that that's not what the statute says.
You're right. We did not make this argument then. We are making this argument now based on largely on the law that has been developed in the last 13 years that really clarified how we look at statutes, how we interpret statutes, especially unambiguous statutes.
So you think the difference between the representation you made in federal court in 2011 and the representation you're making for us today is that this court has modified its approach to statutory interpretation in a way that doesn't permit looking to legislative or statutory history in this situation, or at least should be of discounted relevance?
I don't think what SEIU reflected in 2011 when it and its union partners challenged Act 10 has any bearing here. We are talking about the interpretation of the Peace Act. That case was challenging a variety of changes to the labor laws as unconstitutional. We're talking about a statutory interpretation case now.
Counsel, let me say at the outset that I strongly disagree with my colleague's assertion that to use a holistic approach to statutory construction and interpretation means that you are employing an approach that is outcome-oriented. I remember when I first got on this court, justices like Bill Bablich and Shirley Abrahamson very much employed a holistic approach. So let me give you the question about a holistic approach. A holistic approach in part means that you use all credible, verifiable, substantial tools to find the meaning, right? And you're not bound by, you can go to A only if B is there, and then C, and then you can get to D by A. You're not restricted in your analysis. You use everything that's worthwhile to use to do your job to come up with an interpretation that you think is correct. So one of the things here is legislative history, not statutory, legislative. And legislative history, you don't even argue that it means something other than your clients would lose. Do you? I mean, isn't the legislative history so strong here of what was intended to be accomplished?
Justice Bradley, we recognize that some of the justices, maybe all of the justices, would wish to deviate from a strict traditional plain meaning approach to statutory interpretation. That traditional approach does lead to a finding of coverage here, but optional consideration of statutory history and extrinsic sources can also be used to support or confirm that finding, so we get that holistic aspect built in through that those steps. And although there may be extrinsic sources that apparently support a or arguably support a legislative intent to cut the hospital and clinics and its employees out of the PSAC coverage, it is inappropriate for that material to trump the actual words of the statute. The legislative intent is really meant to be found in the words of the statute, as again, case after case has said, legislative intent is irrelevant to the extent it is not expressed in the statutory language. That comes from the Durain case from 1981. And Fleming in 2023 repeated that principle. So you can't trump the actual words of the statute with things that are not in the statute.
But what's not in the statute is relevant when it was once in the statute. Again, going back to Bonwayless, the court said, we cannot interpret the subsequently amended statute to permit a charge for copies of electronic records, as doing so would require us to read language back into the statute that is no longer there. This we cannot do. That is exactly what you are asking us to do, to read back language that has been repealed.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. The language that's in the statute now incorporates all employers except those that are excluded. It says that the language of the statute is incredibly broad, and that is consistent with the policy behind the Peace Act to begin with. Remember, the Peace Act, I think, predates the National Labor Relations Act, right? So it is designed to be the default labor law for employers and employees in Wisconsin. As we went over on pages 36 and 37 of our opening brief, if the National Labor Relations Act, CELRA, which is the state Labor Relations Act, or MERA, the Municipal Employment Relations Act, if none of those three laws cover an employment relationship, the Peace Act does. The definition of employer is broad, right? It is a person who engages the services of an employee. And there are several exceptions. None of them are the UW Hospital and Clinics Authority. The court, the legislature could have written in an exception to the authority, and they did not. I see my red light is on.
I was going to ask you a question. Maybe you could just talk about it on repeal or on rebuttal. But sometimes the notion of implied repeal or express repeal by subsequent statutes comes into play. How would that have any validity anymore under the argument that you make?
I will think about
Thank
that.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Peter Davis. I'm appearing on behalf of the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission today. As you know, typically an administrative agency is represented by the Attorney General when the agency appears before this court. In this instance, as the record reflects, that's not the case because the Attorney General weighed in on the issue before you and reached a conclusion, or at least suggested a conclusion, at odds with the one the Commission reached, and thus it would have been inappropriate for the Attorney General to appear on behalf of the Commission. Therefore, I am present. I don't have a lot to say. The Commission applied its understanding of your decision in Bray. Based on that understanding, the Commission concluded that statutory history is always part of the analysis that's appropriate. And when we looked at the statutory history, we came to the conclusion that the authority is not an employer within the meaning of the Peace Act. As evidenced by probably the shortest appellate brief you've ever reviewed, we don't have much else to say. But if you have questions, I'm happy to entertain them before I yield to my learned colleague. Let me conclude in the minute or so I have left just by complimenting the parties. The commission's been around for 90 years. Its focus and purpose is to bring labor peace to disputes between parties. With the assistance of Attorney Packard and her colleagues and Attorney Goldschmidt and his colleagues, a strike was averted. That's part of why we're here, as part of that strike settlement, to get a resolution of this issue. So compliments to the parties for that. And the commission appreciates the parties' willingness to engage in the search for a peaceful resolution of problems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you hear me like this?
Yes, or you can lift
raise
it up.
The, or raise my table
a little better. Yeah.
All right, how about that?
Not better.
May it please the court, James Goldschmidt on behalf of the authority. At stake in this case is not only what Act 10 did to remove the authority from the Peace Act, but how Wisconsin courts interpret any statute. A ruling for SEIU would throw this court's very recent precedent in Bray and Banuelos into disarray, with the absurd result that the legislature somehow failed to do what it told everyone quite loudly and clearly it was doing in Act 10. Neither the courts nor the legislature will know what to do with a ruling like that.
Do you agree that the words themselves failed to do it? If I just open up this statute and I want to know who an employer is and how that's defined, it's defined as a person. A person includes a corporation. They're a corporation. They don't meet an exception. I mean, the legislature has an intent that they've reflected in the legislative history, but those words, I mean, can you argue with that?
So we do argue with that. We have an argument that the words alone do not support SEIU's interpretation.
But what is that argument? Because I'm failing to understand that one.
So our argument there is that corporation, as that term is used in the definition of person in the Peace Act, does not include a special entity like the authority, which is a legislatively created public body, corporate and politic. And that when the legislature wants to call out an entity like that, it knows how to do so. It does so, for example, in a different statute, 990.01. In that definition of person, it does not do so here. But the more important point is you have the statutory history available to you that tells you that's clearly not what the legislature intended. My colleague asserts that you can look at it whenever you want.
Yes,
so my question is, why wouldn't you?
Statutory history, it can be problematic, too. People do things for all kinds of reasons, right? For example, in this situation, when UW was first created, my understanding, the authority, it was unclear because it was part covered by all those acronyms from municipal. Part of it was considered governmental, right? I mean, it was. And so the question was, well, how does it fit into this scheme where we've got it? It's kind of like a part. So, you know, when you try to look at intents of why legislatures put things into statutes, you know, trying to really solidify what it was when it was unclear what it was. Now, I think since then, the authority is very clearly, correct me if I'm wrong, really it's a private corporation. I know it's called this body politic thing, but, like, we've got a case out there from the Seventh Circuit that says they don't have sovereign immunity. And we have Rouse, which says that for purposes of notice in lawsuits, they're treated as a corporation. So statutory history can have a place, I guess, but do you concede that sometimes putting something in and taking something out doesn't tell you the whole picture?
I would say that in this case, looking at all of the resources available to you, there is only one clear answer. And that's true going all the way back to Act 27 in 1995. At that time, the entire University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics Authority was under CELRA. It was a state entity. Governor Thompson and his legislature were creating something new, an authority. It was neither fish nor fowl. It was neither fully public nor fully private. It was its own thing. And so the question arose, How do we treat this under Wisconsin's labor laws? It doesn't quite fit under CELRA because it has a private aspect. It doesn't quite fit under the Peace Act because it's partially a state entity. So the legislature said, and it was clear, if we don't carve out a place for it in the Peace Act and expressly put it in there, then it won't be covered by any of Wisconsin's three labor laws. So that's what the legislature did. It was a square peg, round hole situation, because if you look at all of the changes they had to make to the statutes just to fit the authority under the Peace Act in the first place, you see it's not a natural fit, as my colleague contends.
Right, but right now, what is it? The authority is not the same thing it was then, right? It doesn't fit under CELRA anymore.
Right, because of Act 10. So Act 10 removed the last part of the authority that was under CELRA and moved all of that under what is now the authority. So the last vestige of CELRA coverage was removed in Act 10 at the same time that Peace Act coverage was taken away by the same act. And that's all very clear as well. It says at the top of the bill, this will remove the authority from the Peace Act. This will end collective bargaining at the authority. That's unmistakably clear. And any disagreement about when we look at statutory history or whether we look at legislative history doesn't change that conclusion.
Counsel, I have the bill in front of me. Are you referencing instead the legislative history? I don't see in the bill itself that information.
Yeah, we're talking there about the LRB analysis that accompanied the bill.
The answer
yes.
to my question is yes, you're referring to legislative history. Is that
yes,
correct?
Your Honor. Yes.
Tell you, I come, we all talk about predispositions. I have a predisposition that the law should mean what it says and says what it means. And some other justices on this court have that predisposition also and have indeed written it. And I totally agree with it. And I also come from a predisposition thinking that people should be able to look at the statute and the pages around the statute and be able to understand it. So let me say an attorney from Richland County as a hypothetical. I think that if they look at sub 7A, that the language is pretty clear. And so you say, well, statutory history is important here, right? So I look at the statutory history on the page of the statute, and this is what it in part says. History, 1979 C89, 1983 189, 1993 A112492, 1995 A2725, 1999 A65, 83, 209, A28, 185, 2011, A10, 2015, A1. Now tell me how an attorney in Richland County, looking at the legislative history that he or she has before them, how that informs at all their understanding of what is, in my mind, likely otherwise clear. I understand you have an argument that maybe it isn't, but let's say assume that I think that language in 7A is clear. How does legislative history, how should what I just read affect that attorney or that judge in Richland County? How does it inform in an intelligent way how 7A should be at all confirmed or modified?
So my answer to that is that an attorney in Richland County might get that wrong. I grant you that. But this court holds itself to a high standard, and it explains very clearly that when you set out to interpret a statute, you don't just look at the words on the page. You look at the...
Do you think it's okay to have statutes like this? I mean, statutes aren't just
for the courts. They're not just for the legislature. They're for the people of Wisconsin. You know, this is how it regulates their lives, the people, the organizations. So how does that inform the interpretation? I don't know. I look at Act 10 itself, the bill, not the legislative history. And sometimes I'm concerned about, again, the law has to mean what it says and says what it means. The idea, as I understand it, behind the argument that statutory history is part of the plain meaning of the statute is based on a presumption that the legislators are presumed to know the statutory history when they enact a change or modification of the statute. And yet I look at this bill, and I'm just not sure that presumption is correct. Now, we have a lot of presumptions in the law, and some are more congruent with reality than others. And heaven knows, I've embraced a lot of presumptions, you know. Some are more congruent than others. But here I look, and what in the bill will tell the legislator voting on it? And there's no indication in the 1102 sub 7A that there's been a removal of a sentence. There's nothing that really addresses the very issue specifically. That presumption seems perhaps at odds with reality. So tell me, I'm concerned about people, you know, knowing what the statute means, both the reader, both the litigant, both the judges, the citizens of the state, you know. So how can you so readily embrace the presumption and be so sanguine about statutory history here when only those of the selected few really knows what all of these numbers and digits mean? So that bothers me.
I won't presume to speak to the presumptions that led this court to say what it did about how we do statutory interpretation.
I take that.
I can answer the question.
I'm going to correct and add to my statement so he can give a response.
If you need some additional time to get your argument out, we'll do that. This has been a very lengthy question. So go ahead.
Sometimes difficult cases require preface, right? Sometimes difficult cases require pulling in substantial information from a variety of sources. My presumption that I refer to is taken from the Scalia and Garner book as it addresses the issue of extrinsic evidence being part of the plain meaning of the statute. And therein it states that that premise is based on the presumption that I advanced. So now you can respond.
Thank you. I think if we go all the way back to Halal, it directly addresses
Halal.
She's
going to jump over this bench and that's going to be it.
Hard K. It's like the letter, like the alphabet. J-K, Halal.
I even wrote it down right here.
Okay. You're not the only one if you haven't gotten that by now.
If we go all the way back to Halal, it starts from the premise that context is important to meaning. Statutory context is important to meaning. That's something I think we can all get behind. It talks about two types of context. The first type of context it talks about is the surrounding language of the statute. That's what Justice Karofsky was asking about. It goes on to talk about the history of the statutes, the prior enacted law.
Does Kalal mention statutory history? I don't
I didn't think that it did.
It does, actually. And it does so immediately following its discussion of statutory context.
I thought it was legislative history it was talking about.
Yeah. It's both. It talks about both. So when we let's start at paragraph 49 mm-hmm. of Halal, where it says at the bottom of that paragraph, it certainly is not inconsistent with the plain meaning rule to consider the intrinsic context in which statutory language is used. Why? Because a plain meaning interpretation cannot contravene a textually or contextually manifest statutory purpose. And then it goes on in paragraph 52 to continually reinforce this distinction between intrinsic context on the one hand and extrinsic source material on the other. That's the line.
How do we know that?
Just a moment, please. Yeah. My question was, I could do a word search here. Is statutory history, those two words together in K-law? They may be, but I may have missed it, but I don't recall it.
Yes, so the slight distinction is that K-law refers to it as statutory background, and it does so in footnote 9, which immediately follows paragraph 52.
So the answer to my question is no. Now, it
Your
doesn't
Honor,
have
the,
those two words together, right?
The term statutory background, as used in K-law, is talking about prior enacted versions of the statute.
You see, I interpreted that. It specifically and goes at a bit of length, talking about legislative history. But I don't see the words, or I didn't. Could have missed it.
No.
Statutory history reference. You said it's in footnote 9?
Footnote 9, Your Honor, says it refers to an article from Professor Sunstein at Harvard Law School who draws a distinction between legislative history and, quote, statutory background, close quote, the latter term referring to previously enacted and repealed statutory provisions. And that footnote goes on to say, although it is proper to look at a statute's background in the form of actually enacted and repealed provisions, that's what we call statutory history, the legislative history, which was never enacted, should rarely be permitted to supplant the statutory words as they are ordinarily understood. This is the intrinsic-extrinsic distinction, and statutory history is and has since K-law been on the right side of that line.
See, I've never read K-law as referencing statutory history specifically because it never has those words in my mind together. But this is an interesting footnote, and I thank you for it. I'm not sure that I'm wrong. It never says statutory history together.
If I could supplement my answer, Your Honor, the Court's unanimous decision in Bray, paragraph 21, says, we have long recognized a distinction between statutory and legislative history, and then it quotes paragraph 52, footnote 9 of K-law.
Mm-hmm.
So it directly ties out and supports my interpretation that since K-law, the Court has treated statutory history as intrinsic source of plain meaning, not an extrinsic resource.
Thank you.
Counsel, I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more about the statutory history. What do you think your brief goes through a pretty lengthy series of some of the different changes that you think should inform our plain meaning analysis that does incorporate statutory history. Could you please highlight what you think are some of the major ones that you think are most determinative or most helpful in understanding how to read the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, and when I do this, I'm going to be talking about Act 10, because Act 10 is the law the legislature enacted. It is the enacted law. So SEIU's effort to drive a wedge between whatever ended up in the compiled statutes and what Act 10 said is a false distinction. That's the law the legislature passed. So what did Act 10 say about the authority? It said repeal the former statutory provision expressly stating that the authority is a covered employer. Repeal the former statutory provision expressly obligating the authority to engage in collective bargaining. Repeal every provision of Chapter 111, the Peace Act, that referred to the authority, and repeal every provision of Chapter 233, which was the Authorities Enabling Act, referring to the Peace Act. Repeal, repeal, repeal. Legislatures always change law by creating or amending or appealing existing laws. And so you cannot read this act that the legislature enacted without seeing those changes. Those are part and parcel of the law itself. And we don't have to go all the way back to 2011 to understand what SEIU thought that law meant. I believe in response to a question from you, Justice Hagedorn, about the federal position taken in 2011, the answer was a lot has changed since then. So why don't we look at a letter from Attorney Packard to Attorney General Call, dated April 22, 2022, that was submitted as a public comment in response to the governor's request for an understanding of exactly this question. Attorney Packard's letter says...
But what is this? I don't mean to stop you, but I think Justice Hagedorn's question was the statutory history. Have you segued away from that? I'm just trying to figure out where you are in your argument.
The answer that I provided was about the changes that the statute made,
right.
And the statutory history.
Okay, so this, what you're talking about now, I don't understand what a letter from 2011 has to do with the statutory history. You're not arguing that it has anything to do with the statutory history.
I'm actually following up and saying, if we're talking about how the people understood the law when it was enacted, this is good evidence of that. And it says,
Counsel, do we have this letter in our materials?
It's a public record, Your Honor. It was submitted to the Attorney General as a comment on the opinion that he was about to issue about the authority's place under the Peace Act.
I want to take you somewhere else, I think, because you did answer Justice Hagedorn's question. And I want to go back to an argument you make on page 16 of your brief. And I'm still struggling. I'm where I was about 45 minutes ago. If we're looking at context and we're looking at statutory history, I'd like to understand, under your reading of K-Law and its progeny, how those come into play. Do we use because this is why I'm asking this, because on page 16 you write, this is like in the middle of the page, courts must consider context when, then you have when in quotes, not after, and then you have deciding whether language is plain, because oftentimes the meaning or ambiguity of certain words or phrases may only become evident when placed in context. And then you go on to say statutory history, like surrounding and related statutes, is part of that critical context. So if we have a statute, if the meaning is plain, I'm understanding your argument to mean we have to consider context at that time.
Yes.
Okay. And context could introduce ambiguity?
Yes.
What about statutory history? Do we look at statutory history at that same time?
Yes.
Always?
Yes. At least whenever anyone presents relevant key changes to the law, as we've done here. Yes.
And could statutory history also introduce ambiguity?
Yes. Yes. And that's clear from all those quotes came from Bray in that paragraph of our brief. And it's important, again, to go back to this relationship between context of the surrounding statute and statutory history as context. They're both context. So in answer to your question to Attorney Packard, they are not treated differently. They are both used as context to inform a plain reading analysis.
I just have one follow-up. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I completely understand this. So you don't see a lot of daylight, if any, between statutory history and context?
Not as they've been used since K-Law, no.
Counsel, go ahead, Justice.
I'm sorry. I think he ever answered Justice Hagedorn's question, actually.
Well, I thought he did.
Oh, I thought he did.
That's fine. I can follow up after Justice Dowlett.
Okay. I apologize. I thought he did.
Okay. Does your argument depend on the fact that employer is not clearly, that they are a unique body that isn't clearly a corporation? Because I get that, I understand your argument about statutory history and that this was being repealed. I'm still struggling with, if I'm looking in plain words, and it's clear that they have to be a corporation, and they've been treated as a corporation, and there really only are, like, corporations and state entity or government entity and individuals. Like, that's what our world looks like, just generally. That's how we understand corporations. I'm struggling with, regardless of what their intent was, regardless of what they were repealing, that the words on the page still say employer, and that a corporation is an employer. Do you see my struggle here?
I do see the struggle. I think this also somewhat goes back to Justice Bradley's question about, you know, what are we looking at here? How can we just know what it means? The answer I would give is that the legislature itself didn't think employer so plainly included the Peace Act already, because if it had, there would have been no need to expressly add it and frankly do significant violence to the surrounding statutes just to get it in there. And those were a lot of changes in 1995. And if the current language that we're back to now was so broad as to already include the authority, why do all that?
Well, legislatures, I mean, your argument makes sense, but legislatures do that also, right? They just want to make sure something is or isn't covered. I mean, since when do we look at employer and think that it's not broad? Like, just, like, in the word employer, corporation, person, these are, like, broad, right?
I see that my red light is on.
You may continue.
This precisely illustrates why the court should avoid what you all in Bray called a hyper-literal approach to textual interpretation, and why it is essential to look at the statutory history as part of a plain meaning analysis. I would just, if I may, close.
Justice Hagedorn, right?
Yes.
He had a place card holder, too. So
yes,
Your
Honor.
Did you finish your answer for...
thank you.
Does that answer your question,
yes,
Your Honor? Thank you.
All right.
I just wanted to give you an opportunity if you wanted to add anything further in the statutory history. And I do think in light of some of the questions, too, and I think you were going to some extrinsic sources. For example, if you do read the statute to be perhaps susceptible to the reading of SEIU, then you can use other external sources to confirm at times. And so if you wanted to comment on those, which perhaps some members of the court might find relevant to the analysis if necessary, too.
Yes. So it's important for us to realize that despite our disagreement about what happened in Act 10, SEIU has never said that our version of what happened in Act 10 is unreasonable, that our interpretation of that act is unreasonable. And so what you have before you is, at best, a situation where you have two reasonable interpretations of a statute, one blinders on looking only at the words in this little section of the page, one taking into account the sources that you're supposed to in interpreting what those words mean. So if you have those two reasonable interpretations, then you have ambiguity, then we resort to the legislative history. The legislative history is crystal clear. As I believe Justice Bradley said, we win. And SEIU did not put forward an argument as to why that's not the case. It is unmistakably clear what the legislature did here in the legislative history, as in the other sources, and it is our position that there is no inconsistency between any of these things. The legislative history is the same, leads to the same conclusion as the statutory history, as the plain language itself, and there is an element of all of this that I must confess feels a little bit like the emperor's new clothes, where everyone has a firm grasp on reality until a new tailor comes to town and says, I'm going to make you a garment that only the most sophisticated people can see. And now we're presented with this interpretation of what happened in Act 10 that everyone knows is not what happened. And we're asked to accept that as reality. Well, you know what happened to the emperor in the emperor's new clothes.
How long did you practice that anyway?
I had a long drive, Your Honor. But seriously, when we talk about some of the questions come from a place of, couldn't the legislature have been more clear here? Couldn't it have made it so unmistakably clear what it was doing? Could the legislature always say more? Yes. Did it say enough here? Absolutely. I'm proud to say that my mother is here in the audience, and I'd like to think she raised me right. When she took away the keys to the car, did she also have to say, and you're not allowed to drive it? No. And this time, the legislature didn't just take away the keys, it took away all four tires, too. Please affirm work.
Counsel, one last question for you. Are you aware of any principled basis in our cases or in any approach to statutory interpretation that this court has ever adopted that would direct this court to ignore statutory history and to sidestep, if we needed to go there, confirming an interpretation of a statute by looking at legislative history for that sole purpose?
No, Your Honor, and to do that, you would have to overrule your unanimous decision in Bray.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
My mom's also watching. Hi, Mom.
I got to say hi to my mom yesterday.
The corporation claims it's not an authority, but this court told the corporation... Sorry, the authority says it's not a corporation, but this court said in Rouse that it is a political corporation. Benson, therefore, says it is a person. So that's one way to go about this.
So
if
are you
instead
saying,
want to look at...
Ms. Packard, let me ask you this one question, because your friend on the other side ended by saying before the metaphor of the driving and the emperor without any clothes, that SEIU never says the authority's reading is unreasonable. Are you responding to that right now? Is their reading unreasonable?
Oh, their reading is absolutely unreasonable, Your Honor. And I was going to hit that in my closing, but I'll tell you that now because I really appreciate the question. The authority advances an unreasonable interpretation of the statute. It is asking you to ignore what you said in prior cases, especially over the last 13 years, about starting statutory interpretation with the plain language of an unambiguous statute. It asks you to bring legislative, in particular, and statutory history to the forefront to understand what the current words mean and ignore what the words actually say. So it's asking you to make an absurd finding.
But it wasn't so absurd that you accepted that very interpretation and argue that in front of another court, as Justice Hagedorn mentioned at the outset.
You know,
it wasn't absurd to the people who occupied this building after Act 10. It's what everybody understood. And I'll ask you the same question I asked your friend on the other side. I don't see any principled basis here for this court to put the blinders on, which we've said repeatedly we don't do, and ignore statutory history. And then if there is any ambiguity or dispute about what the words mean or what the statutory history means, you can go to legislative history and it confirms it. And it's permissible to use legislative history to confirm it, as we've also said ad nauseum.
The court must look for legislative intent in the statutory.
No, we don't look for legislative intent. I don't care what the legislature intended. I too care what the legislature wrote. And we discern meaning by also looking at context, and statutory history is part of that context. You're asking us to adopt kind of a strict constructionism of statutes, which is putting the blinders on, and that's never been part of our methodology.
This court has taken a very strict textual approach to statutory interpretation, and I'm encouraging you to continue that. But if you want to look at a more holistic approach,
constructionism. There is a distinction between textualism and strict constructionism, and most textualists will completely reject the strict approach that you are asking us to adopt.
The Fleming Court in 2023 said that judicial deference requires that statutory interpretation focus primarily on the language of the statute, and that we assume that the legislature's intent is expressed in the statutory language. So what counsel is saying when he says, oh, but the statutory history shows that the intent was to write the Hospital and Clinics Authority out, they are asking you to find that like you're hunting for butterflies.
We're not hunting.
You have to find it in the language of the statute.
We have it in enacted law. We have it in enacted law. Act 27 was quite explicit in including the authority in the definition of employer. Act 10 repealed that language. You can't win unless you ask us to disregard that statutory history. That's enacted law. That's not looking at what legislators individually or collectively intended. That's looking at what they did.
Your Honor, the Jokic case, I believe, cited in our brief, talks about how removing a provision in a statute doesn't mean that concept is now gone when that concept continues to exist in other statutes. And in this case, so yes, they took the hospital and clinics authority specifically out of the language that named it as an employer. They took it out of 111, out of the Peace Act. But what they left in was the broad definition of employer. They left in a list of exceptions from that definition, and they chose not to, or at least did not, put in to that list of exceptions the authority itself. Opposing counsel claims that it's neither fish nor fowl, that the authority is neither fish nor fowl, and therefore, you know, it doesn't know, it is nothing. It's somehow not covered by the Act. The Act, the Peace Act, covers all employers unless they are accepted. So, and I also want to point out, from a very common sense standpoint, as Justice Dallet notes, for all intents and purposes, this organization operates just like St. Mary's, just like Meritor. It is a multi-state entity with clinics and hospitals and employees in Illinois. The whole point of creating the authority was to make them able to compete with private entities. This is a private entity for all intents and purposes. If it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck.
Counsel? To be clear, your red light, too, has been on for some time.
Pardon me.
And it's good to hear you conclude, but Justice Ann Walsh Bradley has a brief question she would like to ask you.
Yes, I assured that it would be brief, lest we be kept here, right? Context, that's something that's referenced, of course, in trying to interpret a statute. And here, not in 111, but in 49.95, so quite a lot of pages away from the statute that we've been looking at, 40.95, I unearthed the following, and that deals with health insurance premium credits. And it has, in bold, capital letters, note, and then goes on in bold, collective bargaining under subchapter 1 of chapter 111 for employment of the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinic Authority was eliminated by 2011 WIS Act 10. Of what import is that note, and how many volumes separated or pages separated from one another can we stretch context?
That note, as I understand those notes to be, is an editorial note. It is not the statute. It's maybe legislative history. It's not statutory history. And even if we count it as legislative history, but I think it's not. I think it's commentary from the folks who edit the book of statutes. It has no bearing here. The fact is that the state's public policy is to encourage collective bargaining. This public policy is stated in 103.51 sub 1.
This is part of context.
It's part of context, right? The context.
I'm asking
is,
you, is it part of context? Because if you say yes to that, that generally will mean that you will then have it as part of a plain meaning.
Yeah, context is important.
Okay.
Context of the existing statutes is important, and 103.51 sub 1 describes the public policy of the state to be that negotiations of terms and conditions of labor should result from voluntary agreement and that workers should be able to negotiate terms and conditions. And that is the public policy of the state, and it should be implemented here. The court should reject the court's reject the authority's invitation to upend the well-developed law of statutory interpretation, which would replace the intent as reflected in the words of the statute with what the Hospital and Clinics Authority contends is the intent reflected in legislative history, even though it was not expressed in the statutory
Bradley's
language.
Question? Are you still answering the question? Because it's really been a lot over 5 minutes.
I will stop there. This was my final sentence, but yeah. I will. Thank you for your attention,
thank
Your Honors.
All right. Thank you for your interesting oral arguments. The court will adjourn and meet in conference.